Cats and boobs.
Why did you change to being cats with boobs instead of boobs with cats? Or wait.
Because cats with boobs wasn't haunted yet, and boobs with cats was, because every time we tried to record under boobs and cats, it failed. But so far, cats with boobs is working pretty well.
That is an accurate description. We are using a new software, and apparently it doesn't like cats and boobs, but it does like cats with boobs.
Right. Now you and know. Joel picked a stupid screen name. He just called himself Joel, which is
I
lame.
Know. How dare I?
I at least chose something that if you say it fast enough, it sounds like you're beatboxing.
This is true. My name said quickly does not sound like it's beatboxing. It sounds like you might be drowning.
Or it sounds like a very poorly pronounced version of a Dolly Parton song.
Yeah, that's true. And I've gotten that my entire life, and I was just trying to avoid it.
You're welcome. I mean, you could say it's a Miley Cyrus song because she covered it.
That's true. Miley Cyrus, have you heard her recent coverings of, like, old rock songs?
No, I have not.
It's kind of amazing. It's like, wow, she was actually, that was what she was called for this whole time. Not country or pop or whatever. Like, she should have been doing
her voice is very, very good. It's her personality that drives me up a wall. But her voice is phenomenal. She's very talented.
Well, that is an amazing segue to the fact that in every episode so far, we have been judging other people's writings and works. And today, yo get to judge ours. And they get to judge each other's, I guess.
Yo means like either hello or you, like I, you dingus. For someone who answers every telephone call with holas, you should know at least the word yo in Spanish.
Well, I mean, you're not wrong. I don't have an excuse for why I used yo wrong there, but I'm sticking by it.
This is the book report.
What happened last time is we took our entire show and we threw it in the meat grinder and we started doing the thick slurry that came out.
This is true. We will at some point get back to regular regular versions of this podcast, but in the meantime, we're going to have a lot of fun with it.
This is way more fun at the moment.
I don't know
we're
if
doing
I can
read-alongs of C.S. Lewis and ourselves.
No, the read-alongs will never go away, but I don't know if I have the emotional capacity to read my own writing on a podcast every week, because would drive me insane.
Oh, it's okay. We were supposed to record this podcast like 4 days ago, and yours truly didn't get his writing done in time, so...
And I was the one who was without power and living at someone else's house the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's
and
the
I
reason...
I still got my writing done.
If anything, that probably helped you finish faster.
You're not wrong.
Like, come on. We all know we could write the next great American novel if only we lived in a cabin in the woods.
That's 100% true.
Yeah.
You had no distractions except for all the stress that is election week. It's really funny. I saw a tweet the other day that said, from the year that brought you 6 months of March, we bring you Tuesday, the third, or Tuesday, part three. And I was like, nope, yeah, that's accurate. Sure. Well, how do you want to do this? I know we have each other's in front
slowly
of us.
Slowly and gently. It's my first time.
Okay, fair enough. We'll use lots of...
careful.
Yeah, I was about to make it very non-PC. I couldn't think of a literary equivalent, so I was just going to move on. We'll use book jackets and the finger protectors.
I hate this so much. So, just because it's not good.
Go on, you do it.
With C.S. Lewis to cleanse everyone from that one.
Okay, and give us a little bit more time to build up to getting our own written work out there.
Sure. Are we reading each other's on that?
I would like to because all right, we'll I can't, read each other. Actually, I mean, okay, it's harder to read work you're not familiar with, obviously, on air.
That is
but
true.
It's also I'm so nervous about even hearing mine, so I don't really want to read it.
It's okay. You decided to screw me over, but as I was writing mine, I consciously did a couple of things I know you're gonna hate.
Okay, that's
like
fair.
You know how you hate words that you don't know how they're pronounced, especially ones with apostrophes in them?
Mm-hmm.
All the names.
asshole. All right. Well, I still feel like mine's meaner to you, but that's fine. Don't know.
Yours looks like a research paper.
Exactly.
All right.
He's so happy. You made me do research, so I wrote a research
paper. Yeah, for everyone listening, I'm pretty sure Joel wrote his writing prompt in APA format.
He's correct. He made me do a bunch of research because I got really into the science and questioning how things would work. And I was like, this is so much work for a creative writing prompt. I'm going to write it as a research paper. So he feels like he's doing work too.
It's honestly fun. All right. So okay. C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis. Yeah. So we read 4, 5, and 6. We should give a overview of what happened, but if you're reading along with us, you should know. They got to this other planet. We're ending, they're landing on that planet as we end the last chapter we were reading. But the chapters we just read were the journey through space there, which were very interesting. Scientifically, it was interesting that this was written, you know, well before space travel. So all of the ideas of how it would have worked beforehand was
a little inaccurate.
Interesting read. Yeah, just like it wasn't as inaccurate as I would have written before.
True. He got a lot of stuff like fairly right, like the fact that the gravity's a little wonky and the light is always there and bright and all that. Honestly incredible because he published this book in the 30s, like the 1930s. Right.
Yeah, so 3 decades before anyone went to space, he published this rudimentary version of how space would work, but, you know, not bad. There was a whole bunch of emphasis was put on the fact that gravity was towards the center of the ship instead of there just being no gravity. So that was pretty cool. But because no one at that time had experienced weightlessness.
That's true. I guess that's a fair assumption to make if you'd never been to space, because you would just assume, wherever I am on the Earth, which is round, everything is always down no matter where I am, so spaceships should be the same. Because you would think the center of mass would be the center of gravity.
Yeah, and think if you've never seen video of somebody weightless, and think if you've never experienced weightlessness, even like on a roller coaster thing, which didn't exist, like, they wouldn't know how that feels, but he accurately captured the fact that it would be very disorienting.
Well, and to that effect, even in our own lifetime, the ideas of how microgravity work have changed in science fiction. Because if you go into when you and I were younger, it was just like, they've got this thing that produces gravity on the ship. And now pretty much everyone who writes it has some form of the ship is spinning to create the sensation. Yeah, which is more realistic.
If you're The Expanse and the that whole book series and TV show, gravity only exists under thrust, which is how it actually works in space. So it's
right.
Yeah,
it's all shifting to kind of reflect new advancements and ideas about, which I think is interesting. That progression has happened. So it's neat to see kind of the OG experience in C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, there was a weird point in this book that I had to these chapters, I think it was in chapter 5 and 6, the later ones, where he started talking about, I think he's used the words, they resumed clothes. And I was like, what the heck does that even mean? And I had to go back and read it. And were these three dudes just like lounging around in this spaceship nude because it was so hot inside of it for most of the chapter?
You know, I don't remember that part, but that would be very Japanese of them for sure. They're all just hanging out in an onsen.
Well, that's the way it reads. And I can't tell if this is just like 1930s version of nudity with the same gender is no big deal because all swimming pools worked that way and you had to get photographed nude to go to colleges because it was like health and safety. They thought you had to inspect the whole body. Like, I don't know if it was that or if it was the old timey version of nudity where they say they're naked, but they're really just walking around in their boxers.
Right. Right. Like a good old boys club.
Yeah. I couldn't tell which one it was, but they just talked about being naked for a while because it was so hot when they were still near the sun.
I must have missed that. I think though, that the fact that it's kind of hard to tell things like that is also showcased in the second character. So the main character's name is Ransom, and he's on the spaceship with a guy named Divine. Divine is the absolute worst character ever, because normally in a situation like this, Divine's character would be the one that kind of clues the reader into what's going on and gives them like a more full world building experience. Yes, this guy doesn't answer any questions. He's cagey as hell on every question. Ransom's like, "Hey, am I on a spaceship?" And Divine's like, "Are you?" And Ransom's like, "Where are we going?" And Divine's like, "Malacandra." Ransom's like, "Where's that?" And Divine's like, "Nah, I don't know."
He's still better than the other guy, Weston, who doesn't speak, like, period. Like, he's spoken zero lines of dialogue in this entire three chapters.
Yeah, that's a little bit weird. The first time you, like, bring him on in chapter 5, it literally says, Weston, during his watches on, was almost entirely silent.
Yeah. And then the only time you actually hear him speak, like, directly, and it's not even directly because he never translates what Weston says. Mm-mm. He just says he overhears them talking in the other room, but he can still only really make out what one of them's saying.
Yeah, these are all weird characters.
Yeah.
Weird characters.
And I guess that's the big plot advancement that's in these chapters, that he overheard that they're going to somehow sacrifice, give him to the other people, like... It's unclear what his role is, but the aliens specifically requested another person they could have.
Wait, hold up. I just want to read this part, this exchange, because it's really funny if you focus in on the fact that C.S. Lewis never mentions what Weston says, okay? Basically, you can stop me whenever you want, but basically here's what it says. It thus came about that while Ransom could hear distinctly what Divine said, he could not make out Weston's answers. "I think it would be damn silly," said Divine. "If you could be sure of meeting the brutes where we alight, there might be something in it. But suppose we have to trek?" Weston apparently replied. "But he can't find out," returned Divine. Again, Ransom heard the indistinct noise of Weston's voice. "How should I know?" replied Divine. "It may be some sort of chief, much more likely than a mumbo-jumbo." This time came a very short utterance from the control room, apparently a question. Divine answered at once.
Okay, stop.
It would explain why, like
that's really funny. I wonder if we're stumbling onto something intentional. It's not just characterization, that maybe it's like a clue that Weston isn't human or something.
Yeah. It kind of seems that way.
Part of this, like, there's got to be a deeper reason to never have words Weston has actually said.
Yeah.
Since they've left Earth.
It's something, and I didn't really catch that either.
Until we started talking about it.
Yeah, it just kind of escapes you because you're like, oh, Weston's there, and he's talking. Oh, wait, no, he's not saying anything.
We don't have any recorded words of Weston since they left Earth.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to have to go back and look and see what he said while they were at Earth, because he may have been doing that back then, too, and we just didn't pick up on it.
It's very possible. There was a lot going on. There was so much. Oh, man, those first, like, four chapters were just the best.
Yeah, and they slowed down a lot here. Like, a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some beautiful prose in this section that I had highlighted, but including the sentence, "They resumed clothes," which, love. My favorite sentence.
That's pretty entertaining.
That's the only reason I noticed it, because, like we said, you're just kind of reading and going along with it, and then they resumed clothes. And I was like, what? And then went back. And multiple times they mentioned they were naked. But there's other, like, very, like, nice prose. "We have learned how to jump off the speck of matter on which our species began. Infinity, and therefore perhaps eternity, is being put into the hands of the human race." Like, that's beautiful. That's amazing.
That is really good.
A few pages later, he uses the word "thither," which made me laugh.
Sure. Sure.
"Thither, and a womb of worlds." And
C.S. Lewis has his moments where he's really weird in the way he writes, but when he waxes poetic, he's honestly very good at it.
Yes, it's beautiful. Like, it's not quite
he's very philosophical poetic in the way that he brings it out. And I meant to say philosophical, but "waxes poetic" is the phrase, so I got a little in my brain.
Well, I was thinking, like, I was trying to compare him to the guy who wrote Annihilation, that I'm blanking on his name right now, Jeff Vandermeer. He writes almost like poetic prose.
Yeah.
And it's not the same. It's philosophic. Like, poetic prose to me is stuff that is beautifully worded and sounds amazing, but it gives you an ethereal sense. And C.S. Lewis's version, it's beautiful and sounds amazing, but you know distinctly what he's saying. Like, it's very well put and not, it's not obscuring at all. Two opposite ends of that bell curve, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just always impressed when... I think C.S. Lewis is interesting because he is two very distinct ends of the spectrum, where he obviously spent a lot of his time writing for children, so he dumbs things down maybe a little more than he needs to. But then at the other end of the spectrum, he wrote a lot of like theological treaties. So his, or treatises. So his other end, credos. His other end of the spectrum is like very high level to the point where it's almost difficult to follow. So it's rare to find someone who does that. You usually just have one or the other or somewhere in the middle.
I mean, yeah, you're not wrong. I don't. I've said that 5 times this podcast. I'm not allowed to say it again. Yell at me if I say it again.
All right, you're not wrong.
Oh God. I have
title of the episode. Got it.
That's actually good.
Thank you.
I have been fighting a weird migraine all day long, and I finally am starting to feel myself. But there is so much caffeine and like drugs and everything in my system that I'm surprised I'm standing. I have used every single medication in my house to fight a headache, and I've like done nasal rinses and hot showers and all kinds of stuff, and I finally feel like it's breaking.
So, sounds like the weather's changing over in Oklahoma.
Yeah, and it's just that I've been stressed out all week, and I'm finally back in my own bed, so it's like, oh hey, all that stress now it's gonna like go into your brain for some reason. Now that you've unclenched your back. I was writing down the name of this episode and I've forgotten it now.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, there you go.
You're welcome.
Told you, I'm out of it.
I see that.
All right.
So anything else you want to say about Out of the Silent Planet, or do you want to move on to our
I wanted to do, I think we should do like, where's it going next stuff, because the big things we learned in this chapter is that they're bringing him there as some sort of gift or sacrifice to these thuggish, apparently single-gendered aliens. And he's totally like relaxed and cool with it at this point. Like, he's gotten himself a knife if it comes to that, but he's also not fretting or freaking out because he sees no reason to. And I'm just like, I know you don't think there's any way to get out, but like, that's a weird decision to make when you're going to an alien world for the first time ever and you know you're being brought there by those aliens' request, that you're just like, well, I guess I can't fight this. Very strange protagonist. Yeah.
So I don't really know. I don't even know how to guess what's going to happen next, because when we first found these guys, they were kidnapping a special needs guy, apparently for some type of experiment or sacrifice or something. And then they did that with Ransom, our main character, our protagonist. But I can't imagine that the plot is going to go very long if that's the whole purpose.
And unless there's two more books.
Unless we introduce a third character who saves him. So that would be the only way that the human sacrifice or experimentation thing would work. We're going to need to have a third party jump in really soon.
I mean, we are lacking in female characters at the moment, so maybe we'll get one of them.
This book was written in the 30s, so in the kitchen.
Women don't exist.
No, they exist. They're just in the kitchen, cooking, cleaning.
Well, Weston has been in the other room in the kitchen and being silent for a while. Maybe Weston's a woman.
Makes sense. No, it can't be. He's way too quiet.
That's, my gosh. All right. Sexism aside, let's get into our writing assignments. We should like flip a coin or something to decide who goes first.
Sure. You go first. I flipped the coin. It came up.
Okay. So I will read yours first then. Okay. Right. As a refresher, my writing assignment for Steven was to imagine he was, or the story is, a Easter Island tribesman experiences the Dutch first landing there and, you know, in 50 years, this whole society is going to somehow collapse, and he's supposed to write a narrative to explain why this society broke down before the next white man got there.
Oh, as a disclaimer, I do want to say that because you gave me, like, in your writing prompt, you were like, people show up on the island.
Mm-hmm.
Then they return, and it's almost on the edge of collapse. Then, even later, it's gone. I had to do some time jumps to cover all of the things you wanted in there.
Okay. That's fair. I'm excited, and bear with me. I don't like reading out loud much anyways, because I always read faster when I'm not reading out loud. And apparently he's made a lot of things difficult to pronounce, so expect me to stumble over it as I'm reading this.
Would you like me to add comments for like how I would pronounce them off to the side?
Yeah. Anytime we get to one of those words, just let me know how you would pronounce them.
You can also ask, or I can write them off to the side.
Well, okay. This is called The Death of Easter Island by Stephen Race. The priest held up an offering of nuts and berries to the great stone god of Polalathunia.
Polalthanui.
Not close at all.
Polalthanui. Okay.
The priest held up an offering of nuts and berries to the great stone god Polalthanui for the plentiful harvest, he muttered. The meager offering fell upon the fire and vanished in a puff of smoke. Your offering has pleased the gods, priest Akana said to Tram, the farmer from the central highlands of the island. You shall reap a harvest equal to that of last year. Go forth and reap the blessings of the gods. Tram prostrated himself before Polalthanui. Praise be to the great gods of the ancestors. Praise be to the great gods of the ancestors. Praise be to the... Akana left the man to his prayers. There were 30 stone gods, each with their devotee of the day. Some would be asking for rain, others for clear skies. One or two might ask for children, and another might just ask for someone willing to share their hut for the night. Akana didn't care much for the specifics of their prayers. So long as they continued to believe in him as the sole conduit between man and God, he would make the rounds later this afternoon, but first he needed some time for himself to pray. He jogged up the thin path that led to the high god at the top of the mountain. Roror Asani, god of the wind. Asani, as his priest called him, was a moderator of the weather, and an island such as theirs owed everything to him. Asana brought the rains. Asana brought the waves that brought the fish. Asana brought the warm breezes from the north that caressed them in the night. Only Asana was reserved for the priests, and the priests alone. He removed his sandals and his knee-length tunic, laying them in a neat pile at the edge of the cleared circle. Only in his nakedness could he approach the god of gods. Akana trembled in the cool morning air, relishing the light touch of his master. He took a small knife and cut an incision on the inside of his thumb. The thin scar opened readily at the touch of the knife. Akana sprinkled a few droplets of blood around the base of Asani and sucked on his thumb to stem the bleeding. O most gracious and high god, you are the invisible, but always present. You are the mighty and the calming. You hold the power of the galaxy in the shell of a turtle and unleash it upon those whom you will. I ask, as your humble messenger, for a continued sign of your favor upon these, my people, that they may continue to bring offerings and show their reverence. Upon the completion of the prayer, Akana spat out the mixture of blood and spittle he'd been holding in his mouth. It carried in the wind for a moment before landing in the body of Asani. A favorable sign. Akana looked up at the horizon for a thundercloud or a tidal wave to show the presence of the god. There was nothing. Nothing. Except... Akana took off like a sparrow towards the beach. In his haste, he left behind his clothing, but this was too important. He'd seen trees coming over the water. Trees! That could only mean that Asani, in his infinite power, had seen fit to bring additional land to the people who loved him above all others. Imagine! More land for farming, more land for homes, more land for the people of the world. Their tiny little island would soon grow at the pleasure of Roror Asani. Akana stood at the edge of the beach as a little piece of land bobbed atop the waves. His little island would soon be made into a nation worthy of the gods. Pause. Did it get Roror Asani anywhere close to right?
Perfect, actually.
Yes, okay. All right, I think this is a time jump now.
Yes.
King Akana, ruler of the people and intermediary of the gods, offered up his own finger, holding it aloft to the wind and allowing Asani to taste the devotion and the prayers nestled within his own lifeblood. Scars crisscrossed his arms, his legs, his back, but over the past sun cycles, no more land had appeared over the horizon. And worse, the first land had left after the people who lived on that tiny island had traded some of their dead trees for food and women. Now, Akana needed something to show his people that they had not placed their faith in the wrong man or the wrong gods. He walked in a slow circle around the giant stone statue of Rurora Sani and placed his hand against the only exposed portion of the statue, the head. As he walked, the blood flowed freely from his hand to form a bloody necklace around the god of the wind. Hear my prayer, O great father of the skies. Listen to your people whose words float away from their lips by your power. Bring us the land which was promised us. Akana looked out at the horizon, first to the sun, then in all other directions. He saw nothing out of the ordinary, the same unbroken horizon he'd seen every day for the past 2,000 sun cycles. Asani has abandoned you, Tuati shouted. He was a minor priest, but he commanded a large following among the fishermen on the island. It is time you step aside to allow for one whom the gods have favored. Murmuring swept through the crowd. To a casual observer, it sounded like agreement. To Akana, it was nothing short of betrayal. You would lead the people astray, Tuati, he boomed. You and your followers worship Alga... Oh my god, this is the worst one. You and your followers worship Algathi Aioli.
Nice.
Anything?
That was good.
Okay. Algathi Aioli. His watery palace is no place... is no match for the splendor of the heavens. The sea is mighty and constant, Tuati said. It provides us with the food we eat. What has wind given us? Do we not eat the birds of the air? Akana retorted. Only the ones who alight upon the ground, Tuati said. Rurora Sani protects the birds from us, as until the moment they enter the domain of you... until the moment they enter the domain of Gigi Luau.
Nice.
Gigi Luau? Yeah, Gigi Luau. Min grunted in agreement. A shout of Tuati went up from somewhere in the back of the crowd. A blood sacrifice has been enacted, King Akana said with his bloody hand held high. Asani will answer our prayers. Akana, Akana, a different voice began to chant. Before he realized what was happening, the crowd split roughly in half, and the two camps of people screamed rough and loud. They came together in a frenetic energy of the zealous, each one possessed with the ardor for their god. Akana tripped over a rock as he dodged a club swinging for his face and put his hand up to ward off the final death-dealing blow. Save me, he prayed. A clap of thunder split the air. There were no clouds. Akani's assailant dropped silently to the ground. Two more pearls of thunder struck, and two more of Akana's islanders fell to the ground. Akana rolled over to the side and looked to the beach. There, sitting in a cove that provided such excellent cover from the storms, sat a bit of floating land, even larger than the first. The men who lived on the island were marching steadily up the hill, each sending fire and lightning into the air with their strange-looking staves. And who controls the thunder and lightning but the mighty Rurora Sani? Akana offered up the last... Oh, this is another break.
Time jump.
Jump. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Akana offered up the last infant of the island and laid the cooing child upon the stone. Wow, sorry. I'm going to try to read that again because it threw me off. Akana offered up the last infant of the island and laid the cooing child upon the stone altar erected for the purpose. This child, as the only member of Akana's dwindling tribe still living, represented their entire future. 4,000 sun cycles had passed since the messengers of Asani came and delivered Akana from the hands of Tuati. 4,000 sun cycles had passed since Akana realized what Asani wanted most of all was simple. Blood. He knew at the moment those messengers slaughtered hundreds of Tuati's people in the span of an hour. From using signs, Akana had discovered that the messengers of Asani used the power of Asani to float their little islands whatever they pleased. From that moment on, Akana had become a preacher of death. It was Asani's will that our blood be spilled for his pleasure. Only then would the islanders be resurrected as messengers of Asani themselves. Fated to roam the winds for all eternity, with lightning and thunder held in their hands. They would deal out justice to those that dared oppose the mightiest of gods. But they needed an island, one more. They needed an island once more. Without a floating island, the bones of those who had died would forever be locked to the land. Hundreds had offered themselves up in sacrifice on the altar of Rurora Sani, yet no island returned. Akana preached auto-sacrifice to the masses. He extolled the virtue of a life given up in return for immortality, and ultimately he promised to spare a single child to carry on the bloodline of the island. Akana knew what had to be done. To prove his total devotion, he must sever all ties to the earth. Hear our prayer, O Asani. Hear our prayer, O Master of the Skies. With that simple prayer, he plunged his crude knife into the infant's chest and tore it through the soft sternum and bone. The child shrieked and was gone. With a joyous heart, Akana held the body aloft, hurled it against the stone face of Rurora Sani. In that moment, the statue came to life. Eyes red as blood shone like the evening sun. A piercing scream split Akana's mind open and laid bare all that he was and had done. In an instant, his sanity left him, borne off on the winds. Naked, he ran from Asani. Naked, he ran through the town. Naked, he leapt from the cliff and sailed through the air. In his final moments, he was one with Asani. He felt nothing but the pure weightlessness of falling through the cool caress of his master. So enamored he was with the sensation, it never crossed his mind to scream when the bones shattered against the rocks. The end.
The death of Easter Island.
That was very nice.
Aww,
I mean, obviously it was very violent and graphic at the end, but it was very nice.
Yeah, I was originally going to write it that basically everyone got smallpox, but then I decided, you know what? Death cult. Sounds better.
Huh. I mean, it's really interesting. It's not, I mean, we don't know exactly what happened, obviously, which is why this prompt was fun, but it's not far off from what most likely happened at all. And I love the, evolution of the god. I love the evolution of even the statue, how it changed from scene to scene, time zone to time zone or whatever. Mm-hmm. It worked really well, and the progression was clear, and yep, that's how death cults go, and that's how interaction with seemingly higher powers goes.
The one thing I was trying to do, and I don't know if it came through very clear, was that the first sacrifice he offered was nuts and berries. The second one was a cut. The third was an entire finger. And then the final one was an infant before he finally sacrificed himself.
I didn't catch the entire finger, but I did.
As you were reading it out loud, I was like, ooh, I didn't make that one as clear as I should have.
It did seem that he didn't just prick his finger, because his whole hand was an arm was covered in blood this time. So it was obviously a deeper cut is what I just took it as. Not that he missed a finger, but yeah.
Yeah. As you were reading out loud, that's how I also took it. And I knew what I had written. I'm like, oh, I just made a cut. Okay. So,
well, thank you for making it as difficult as possible to read out loud, but also not as difficult as possible to read out loud, because it wasn't a lot of compound sentences. Did have a bunch of made up and annoying names, but at least the sentence structure, and plus I know how you write and talk, so I could flow with the sentence structure, because reading something unfamiliar out loud usually trips me up.
It's hard.
I didn't so much.
I also, honestly, I wasn't actually trying to write the names of the gods to trip you up. I was trying and probably failing to make them at least look like they would have fit in some type of like Polynesian culture.
No, it does have the feel of Polynesian culture, obviously. Especially Tuati, that's a really good one. And the Gigi Lua one, Luau, those both look, I mean, they look like they're Hawaiian gods I know that they're called Moai statues, and the island is called Rapa Nui. And so these, in their own language, so these words fit with that sound of language. Obviously, neither of us come close to speaking anything like Polynesian, so we are probably butchering all of it.
No, we do not.
But it had the feel of that, even though we may be cursing people out in a language we made up to mimic their language.
That's fine. You know what? If they all actually sacrifice one another just to get the ships to come back, kind of deserve it, I guess.
Yeah, who wants British people showing up at your front door and taking your statues and land? Come on.
These guys are dicks. They're notoriously not good to native populations.
Exactly. Well, I have some difficult to pronounce names, but they're all real people, so you can't get mad at me for that.
All right. Well, are you ready for me to read yours?
No, I'm still nervous, but go ahead.
All right. So for those of you listening, the writing prompt I gave Joel was very vague, honestly. So I'm interested to see what he did with it. All I said was basically, imagine that people have been living on the moon since basically the beginning of history, just as people have been living on Earth, and kind of run with that. Make something up for me. And so we'll see how it goes. Did you have any other interpretation of that you want to add, Joel?
No, I would just say that as you're reading this, I would probably just go ahead and read the main text and then all of the extra things we can go over afterwards.
I was going to ask that. Read okay, cool. Yeah.
Instead of stopping every time it pops up, I want to read it then. It would just flow.
Yeah, and again, I just want to point out, just so everyone's clear, this stupid thing that Joel wrote has 19 comments and 20, sorry, it has 19 footnotes and 23 citations.
You're lucky that the power was out, because I was going to print all this off and then write all the teachers' comments on it with pen and then scan it back in.
You're so fun.
I made it, for those of you who are wondering, I made it more of a visual thing than it works for audio. So apologies for that. We'll have a link to a document, but I made it as if this is a I made it as this was a term paper that has been turned in and graded and returned to the student. So there is the paper itself and then all the teacher's comments written on it.
Yeah, to be fair, this student should get a shit grade if there are this many comments on it. All right, I'm going to go ahead and read.
Go ahead.
All right. History of the Lunar Aggression Against Earth. Luna sits at roughly 240,000 miles away and a little over one quarter the size of the Earth. It once sustained more than 1 billion lives in at least 40 distinct cultures and people groups. We sit 50 years removed from the counter-invasion and destruction of the lunar homeworld. Although the subjugation and destruction of the lunar people has evolved from being seen as a necessary and appropriate response to their war-faring factions' attack against the Chinese and Russian states, many are questioning the results. Taking a longer view of lunar history sees multiple points in which compassionate, cautious, or simply intelligent responses to the existence of lunar life could have prevented NATO's actions. In this essay, I will highlight several moments in which human responses to lunar aggression could have fundamentally changed the way our celestial codependent worlds inevitably met one another. Galileo asserted all the way back in his Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems that life could exist on the moon, although it would be in such a state as to be nearly unrecognizable by us. Quote, I am certain that a person born and raised in a huge forest among wild beasts and birds, and knowing nothing of the watery element, would never be able to frame in his imagination another world existing in nature different from his. Thus, and more so, might it happen that in the moon, separated from us by so much greater an interval and made of materials perhaps much different from those on Earth, substances exist and actions occur which are not merely remote, but from completely beyond all our imaginings, lacking any resemblance to ours, and therefore being entirely unthinkable. For that which we imagine must be either something already seen, or a composite of things and parts of things seen at different times, such are sphinxes, sirens, chimeras, centaurs, etc. End quote. Although he goes on to say that he does not believe there to be plant or animal life on the moon, he concedes that it may exist. Very different and entirely unimaginable by us. End quote. He still challenged convention of the time, asserting that the moon was neither a smooth ball, nor was it and the sun revolving around the earth. He was willing to face house arrest and persecution for his mathematical and visual certainty on these points. Quote, what is clearly seen in the moon is that the darker parts are all plains, with few rocks and ridges in them, though there are some. The brighter remainder is all fill of rocks, mountains, round ridges, and other shapes, and in particular there are great ranges of mountains around the spots. Though I fancy to myself that its regions are not idle and dead, still I do not assert that life and motion exist there, and much less that plants, animals, or other things similar to ours are generated there. Even if they were, they would be extremely diverse and far beyond all our imaginings. I am inclined to believe this because, in the first place, I think that the material of the lunar globe is not land and water, and this alone is enough to prevent generations and alterations similar to ours. But even supposing land and water on the moon, there are, in any case, two reasons that plants and animals similar to ours would not be produced there. End quote. Furthermore, it was in his addled and house-arrested mind, in which he looked upon the lunar face one final time through his ingenious telescope, that we have the first, albeit possibly apocryphal, proof of indigenous lunar life. Quote, it still moves, end quote, he is said to have repeated his infamous line about the Earth's motion upon his deathbed, this time adding, quote, and upon it so do lives such as ours, end quote. It is unclear what, if any, evidence of the lunar peoples he would have seen with his primitive telescope. However, archaeologists have determined that in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, there was a coordinated effort from several tribes of the lunar people to contact Earth. A series of mighty bonfires burnt in their pictographic language crisscrossed the rises above the tranquil sea. These signal fires would have been burnt while on the far side of the lunar surface and therefore invisible during the time it faced Earth. There is some argument to be made that their customs would have led them maintaining the flames well into the twilight zone and briefly been visible from the surface of Earth. These fires would assuredly have been visible with a telescope that it was able to see the rings of Saturn. This, of course, is conjecture, but if we were able to fight against religious and cultural belief at the time and know that life existed alongside us in the 17th century, efforts to communicate and the understanding that this life was perhaps more advanced than we were would have drastically changed the trajectory of our two peoples. A full two centuries later, we finally made contact with lunar people, and once again, they had been screaming into the void long before we decided to listen. In 1894, French physicist Edouard Branly built a storm alarm made up of a battery, a coeur, and an electric bell, which went off when it picked up the radio waves generated by lightning. Upon demonstration of his radio receiver, he couldn't stop picking up a seemingly omnipresent interference and thought his experiment a failure. It took another 2 years for Guglielmo Marconi, the father of radio and the first person to hear the voices of Luna, raised a receiver into the sky to test long-distance radio transmission and heard a message from the stars. Quote, "It is as if these signals have always been there, rebounding in the void, waiting for me to invent the technology to hear them." End quote. Scientific and, again, some prevailing religious conventions at the time refused to allow for life outside of the planet Earth. Scientific communities, however, were more vigorous in their ostracism of anyone who sought to respond to these messages or explain them as anything other than background radiation from the sun and stars. Even when Nikola Tesla published a series of mathematical formulas that proved the unusual radio waves not only originated at the lunar surface, but also that they were too regular and repetitive to be anything but language, the Western scientific community balked at the very idea that anyone could be more advanced than they were. The U.S. government at the time even confiscated his papers, attempting to translate the works and only released them in 2016 after a Freedom of Information request. There was, in fact, no peer-reviewed published work on the radio waves until the lunar people boosted their signal. We still don't know how they did it, but everyone has heard the stories passed down from their families or seen it immortalized in film and TV. The 1930s week of desperate lunar signaling we now believe may have been a cry for help, the nations of Earth believed it an opening salvo, and that became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The messaging set nearly all metallic surfaces under the lunar shadow to buzz with an incredibly powerful radio signal we still cannot fully translate because our recording equipment at the time was so badly damaged. In the years that followed, we finally sent back our own messages with mathematical formula and baseline information. Here is where most scholars point to our best and last chance to open a dialogue with Luna and avoid the actual violence that followed. Until World War II broke out and stopped all international work, we had nearly broken the strange coded language they were sending us. This was perhaps the best chance of stopping the hostilities, but it was certainly not the last. Earth spent the next three decades starting and attempting to finish the work that a radical faction of the lunar people would soon take over. Namely, we tried to wipe ourselves off the face of the planet. In 6 years, we killed 85 million human beings. Then, to top things off, America dropped the two most destructive weapons ever created at that time to wipe out another 230,000 lives. Luna was watching and watching very closely. The two factions that perhaps mirrored Axis versus Allies sentiments in the same way Luna itself mirrors the sun for us, warred over the appropriate way to deal with Earth. After centuries of us pretending they do not exist and then hastening the destruction of ourselves and our planet as soon as we finally acknowledged them, the radical faction won out. The rocks fell. Death estimates are to this day unreliably vague. Initial impact of the first stone changed the shoreline of the continent of Asia. Its resulting tidal waves and volcanic eruptions, fires, and dust cloud easily doubled or tripled the immediate death toll. We were lucky the second stone fell not on hard ground, but the Pacific Ocean. Still halved again the destruction from the first rock. All told, 1950 saw the deaths of at least an additional 1.5 billion human beings. Here we pause. The prevailing sentiment is that this crime cannot go unanswered, that no one on Earth would let this wholesale slaughter of humanity pass. But just a decade before half the world went to war for the right to commit genocide, and the good guys wiped cities off the map and changed the shoreline of a country, not with rocks from space, but bombs built by man to kill man. The argument then turns to say that we punished those who committed atrocities, and we dropped those bombs to stop even more deaths. In reality, Nazi scientists who were responsible for creating death machines and engineers who made concentration camps and gas chambers were brought to America to build the machines we used to get to Luna. When we got there, with the benefit of time, they built more effective means of wholesale slaughter. Mankind proved it is capable of forgiving the worst crimes, but seemingly only if that leads to the forgiving party being able to commit graver sins. There was one final moment that we could have stopped the destruction of the lunar people. It seems almost impossible to say, but John F. Kennedy, the lunar conqueror himself, was not only in the final position to save the lunar people, but actually wanted to do just that. JFK, of course, paved the way for the lunar landings. He launched the first nuclear bombs against the lunar people. He authorized experimental chemical warfare. He, on multiple occasions, was cited as wanting to lead a force on the lunar surface. Although he was assassinated a year before the first man stepped on the dusty surface, 4 before the first concentration camps were built, and a decade before the last of the lunar species died in transit back to Earth, he is credited with our absolute victory against them. Looking at his early speeches on the subject, it does not sound at all like a man who would want to wipe an intelligent species from the universe. In speaking of nuclear war, he said, quote, "Total war makes no sense in an age when great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces," end quote. How much more so would this have applied to war with the moon, who could bring about destruction many magnitudes beyond our most powerful weapons at much greater ease? He was forced into his assault against the moon. His first speech on the topic can be read as reluctant but steadfast, if his people wish it. Quote, "We do not want a war. We do not expect a war. This generation of Americans has hardly ready had an, I'm not doing this anymore, more than enough of war and hate and oppression, but we shall be prepared if others wish," end quote. Even his most famous words can be read not as a declaration of war, but a celebration of human ingenuity. Quote, "We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard, because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that battle is one that we must accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win," end quote. JFK's assassination is so plagued with controversy and conspiracy, it is an inescapable quagmire to examine closely in any scholarly article not dedicated to that purpose. It is, however, a disservice to readers to not at least mention that there are many, including members of the Kennedy family, who believe he was assassinated at least in part due to his pacifistic sentiments towards the lunar people. We will never know what President Kennedy wished for once we landed on the moon. We unfortunately only know the horrors of what happened there. The lives and knowledge of a seemingly primitive early industrial revolution society that was able to bombard the surface of a planet 240,000 miles away with radio waves at a frequency and volume that we cannot reproduce 2 centuries later, or who were capable of launching inert projectiles with devastating precision, are now lost to time. We had opportunity after opportunity to interact with our closest celestial neighbor in a mutually beneficial symbiotic way. Our own stupidity, stubbornness, and bloodlusted vengeance stopped us at every turn. This was perhaps more inevitable than any of the most cynical could have predicted. In what is known as the first ever science fiction story, Lucian and his fellow travelers are caught in a whirlwind and taken to the moon and immediately get involved in a war in which ultimately the moon is defeated at the end.
Love that you used the JFK voice.
Dude, the third time I got to a quote, it was almost like I couldn't not. I just kept imagining him speaking at a podium. I was like, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country."
I knew you had it in your repertoire, but I didn't think you would have, like, I didn't think as I was writing that you would go into the voice. But as soon as you started reading it, I was like, "Oh, he's going to do the voice."
I could not help it. Like, the intonation was there, the cadence, and I was like, shit. So for everyone listening, I just want them all to know that during college, I reviewed and edited many of Joel's papers. Yes. This one is better than all of them for some reason. The stuff you submitted to your professors was worse than this.
Well, I've had a lot of like actual professional writing that I've had to do since then.
Yeah, your academic writing has gotten a lot better since college, weirdly enough. So congratulations, bud.
Thank you. Yep. I also had the benefit of grading this one, and I think I may have done myself a disservice doing that.
I honestly can't believe you spent the time to both write and grade this.
Well, like, the idea was that it adds a whole extra layer to the story, but I don't think it needed it. Hearing it read out loud, I don't think it needed the teacher's notes.
I mean, it was good, though. I think if you, like, post this in the right spot of the internet, give it 15 years, and this could become a legitimate QAnon theory.
That's how I felt at times writing it, but I really... Yeah. The reason it came out as a term paper instead of a short story, really, is because I got so into the idea of if there's life on the moon the whole time, then how does it work? Like, what does that life look like? And when would we have noticed? So I started doing actual research onto, you know, how we addressed the moon over the years, and found the Galileo's discourse of the two chief world systems, those quotes, I barely changed those quotes. Those are actual directly from him. That. So he actually thought about this, and he was scientifically intelligent enough to believe that there was nothing up there, but he talked about what it would look like if there was.
Yeah.
And from there, I was like, okay, I've done all of this research. And then I started doing, thinking about how, you know, the rest of history would have been different if we had been contacting people on the moon way back then. And once I realized that I had pulled quotes from several famous people throughout history, I realized I'd done half the work for a paper. Yeah. And then I got off on this sidetrack of like, okay, well, what else would I do with this short story? What would be the point of it? And I thought I could make it, you know, I could make it like a position paper and talk about anti-colonialism. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, or I could make it, you know, an anti-war piece, or I could make it all this stuff. And once I started doing that, I realized I was writing a paper because that's what school papers do. They go off on random tangents and make other like side arguments for whatever their main argument is. And I was like, okay, if I'm writing a paper, I'm writing a paper, and just started doing it. And it worked out really well.
Well, stylistically, it was on point. It was even a little bit dry, which works with what you're going for. It very much was not narrative in any way, shape, or form. I mean, like, there was a narrative to it, but it wasn't written in narrative style, which I kind of liked. It was trickier to read because it doesn't have like the I don't know what I'm trying to get at. It doesn't have the like Chekhov's gun entering the scene
stuff.
But it was interesting. Like, I really did enjoy reading it, and I always love it whenever you take either real quotes or slightly tweaked quotes and build stories around it, because it kind of adds a layer of, ooh, maybe this actually did happen and the wool was being pulled over our eyes the whole time. Ho ho ho. And I like that stuff. It's always kind of cool. So I would say job well done with a terrible writing prompt. Excuse me.
Well, thank you. And I would say the same to you. I don't normally I have a love-hate relationship with things that jump through time. And you did a really good job of pulling that off in a really short piece of fiction. So that was impressive.
Thank you. So here is my, if you want to talk about these a little longer, we can, but what I was going to have us do was say, if we had written to our own writing prompt, would we have gone in a different direction with it?
Ooh, yes. Okay. I love that. I just wanted to say a couple more things about mine. Absolutely. Before we move to that. If you want to see the full visual of mine, because it's kind of a more visual medium, we can post a link to it like we did with the writing prompts. But the gist of all the teacher's notes are I made the teacher character an actual teacher I had, who was this racist, horrible old man, history teacher. And would get mad at you and grade you really poorly if you disagreed with his terrible political views. And so this teacher gives the student a C+ because they technically did the work, but all their opinions were wrong. And he is of the very conservative point of view that wiping out everybody on the moon was a good idea. And that just comes across as he's kind of ranting towards the student in all the side notes.
Well, I kind of like that because in reality, there would be a number of people who would argue that point if this had actually happened.
Yeah. And I felt like I got to the point where as I was writing it, I wanted to tongue-in-cheek make fun of it.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the only reason way I could figure out how to do that was to put the teacher in there. And I was like, nah, and I can also use him to be the racist POV on this.
Absolutely. Or
xenophobic view on this.
Yeah, it'd probably be xenophobic.
Yeah.
Have you finished the second book in Three Body Problem yet?
No, I have not. But we talked about it. You text me about it, and that's one I recently started reading, which is one of the reasons I haven't finished.
No, that's
the Dresden Files. Totally yet.
Fine. It's just that you touched on a theme that comes out in that book that I wanted to bring up, but I don't want to accidentally ruin it for you.
Oh, okay, interesting. Well, that makes that's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, what would you
remind me of that next once you finish the book, and we can kind of discuss that because I thought it was a cool theme.
Absolutely will do.
Yeah. And there was some, and like I said, whenever you get to that part in the Dresden Files that's going to make you mad, please text me immediately because I want the raw
emotions.
Thank you.
Rest assured I will.
you'll know what I'm talking about when you get there. No worries.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So
what would you have done if you had got your own prompt?
Yeah. If I would have written my own prompt, I think I would have gone from a narrative perspective, partly because I'm not as like genre breaking as you tend to be, because you've read a couple of books like this where it's a more like meta story. Like I knew you read a book at one point that had like things inside the book that you had to pull out and put together to figure out
the title of the book. It's called S by J.J. Abrams and Doug Durst.
I knew
right next to me.
I figured because I saw it the last time I was at your house. I know like you like stuff like that, and so you are going to be better at it. So I wouldn't have written like that just because it's outside my wheelhouse. I though really, for some reason, couldn't tell you why, I really like the age of exploration and the age of British colonialism. So I probably would have written it in that type of a thing. So basically I would have written it as kind of like in the 1400s, since we have seen the world or the moon for so long, instead of building like fleets of ships, all of human ingenuity went into creating space travel way sooner. And then things progressed from there, kind of in a colonialist faction. And I don't know where I would have ended, but that's where I would have started.
I like that. And I can feel that, and that's how I felt like I was being pulled because we're currently reading Out of the Silent Planet, and so I actively resisted that. I didn't want to set it in that time frame.
Smart. Yeah.
But my original vision was to do it just – and I realized I just couldn't do it in under 5,000 words, but I was going to like just jump back and forth from the moon and Earth and follow the two paths of how they saw each other and met each other kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that there's no way I could have done it in that short of time frame.
So. That's totally fair. Totally fair.
Yeah.
So how would you have done your writing prompt?
I am not sure. And I think I had 5 or 6 writing prompts written for you, and I chose this one because I was the least sure of what I would do if I wrote it. Because there's so much out there. And I've recently listened to a couple episodes of a podcast that was about Rapa Nui specifically. And there's this – the opening of one of the podcasts describes one of this bird cult rituals. And it was so interesting to me, just the description of that ritual. And I realized that that's one of my favorite things to read is the evolution of people's mythos and how old-timey religions were practiced. And I was like, I want to see a story of what happened in the meantime, what we missed in this fascinating unexplained – you know, people group.
Yeah.
So I would have done something very similar to you. Probably I would have made up a new religious ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would have done the time hopping. I would probably have just stuck to a, like the specific climactic moment when two religious groups or two religions themselves fought and they destroyed the Easter Island heads after.
Yeah.
So I think you took a much broader view of it, which I liked because it told a bigger story. But I think I would have done just like one scene and have like a hero character sacrifice himself or something.
I don't know. I thought about that for a while. I just didn't want to write kind of like when you're reading a story and the main character like flashes back in their own mind and they're like, He remembered a time he was sitting with his grandfather, and his grandfather was whittling wood and told him blah, 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 blah. And then that's like the key to unlocking whatever's going on in the present day. I don't always like things that feel like an entire story of flashbacks. Gotcha. Which is why I decided to do the scene one, scene two, scene three. But I think I would probably have been able to pull off your plan better if I was a stronger writer. Because I think
I'm that would take, I mean, we had like a week to do this, a little over a week to do this. And short stories are, they're small, they're short. They don't take a lot of time to actually physically write. But because you have so little space to develop ideas, they're really hard.
And to be fair, the whole reason the main god was the wind god was because you said the thing about the bird cult.
Okay.
So and it there was in there, but there wasn't like enough allusion to it.
Well, that was specifically one of the things I threw in there because it is not a, even if you research Rapa Nui and Easter Island for like a few hours, you wouldn't necessarily come across this bird cult thing because it's such a tiny little piece of it. So it was interesting to me and I wanted to see what you imagined for when I said bird cult, because I have a clear view of reality of what they actually did because we have one of those ceremonies still. But if I just said the word bird cult, where do you take it? And it was a new one.
Yeah, basically the way I took it was that means that they worship the wind, which also was kind of fun because normally when you think of polytheistic societies, the head god is the sun god in almost every single one of them. Mm-hmm. You don't usually get a god that is, I don't know,
not the sun being the top one. But you strangely do get like the storm god being always really, I mean, you get Zeus once, he's the head, and then you get Thor, who's not the head, but he's like the strongest and the most talked about god. So wind is an interesting one to take. I like that because it's still the god of the storm, but it's every all encompassing of the wind. That was a better way to think of it. It's not just the storm, it's also controlling just nature in general. The wind is in charge of nature. So
and it brings the boats.
The islands, the other lands. I really liked that description of the boats because that's a good point that you, I mean, that's one thing that Easter Island, the people that lived there, could never get more of and would not know there was more of after a few generations because it's a tiny little, it's like an island and like two other tiny little islands. There's nothing else in view. And there's not enough wood on the island to build a boat to go find anything else. So Easter Island was their whole world.
Well, I thought this was fun. It was kind of hard to fit it into my normal schedule. And writing short stories is kind of hard because I actually have to find an ending. So it was probably practice. And
this was really fun, but we definitely can't do it every week.
No, my brain broke.
Yeah, this was not something we can do every week, but I really liked it and the way it turned out. And I have plenty of prompts left over. Maybe we should do more of these.
Absolutely. I'm a fan of it. It's good practice, if nothing else.
Yeah. It's fun, but yeah, it was a struggle. I think I started writing like 4 days after I got the prompt because I couldn't decide where I was going with things. And then I had all the research and I was like, all right.
Time to compile it.
Yeah.
Finals are next week. Gotta finish. Mm-hmm.
It's very, very age regression there for me.
Sure. All right. Well.
Well, we will see y'all next week, but we don't really know what we're doing yet for next week's episode, so stay tuned on that. But we will be reading the next two chapters of Out of the Silent Planet. Just two chapters this time, so we can be on to an even number of chapters.
Yep, yep.
If you're reading along.
Which you better read
along.
It's a pretty entertaining book, and it's not
really entertaining. Yeah, it's very short.
Are like, very short.
You could catch up with us tomorrow if you really wanted to.
Yeah, it would take you all of maybe 45 minutes to read the six chapters. Maybe.
Yeah, it's. I mean, that's putting it, stretching it a little bit. Most people aren't speed readers, Stephen. It would take you maybe a couple hours to catch up with us, but that's a maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right. Well. If you had, if you answered the writing prompts of your own and you wanted us to see them, we may read them on air someday or talk about them later. You can email it to us at bookreportpod@gmail.com. If you have any comments on our takes of Out of the Silent Planet or really anything, you can reach us On Twitter at @book_pod, Facebook at @book_report_podcast, and Instagram at @thebookreportpod with underscores in between each word, because Instagram makes it difficult.
It's true. It's because we didn't pay extra.
Yeah, because who pays for things?
Oh, wait, I wasn't supposed to pay from my personal Instagram? Well, who have I've been sending checks to?
I'm not sure, but probably someone who's selling all of your thirst trap pictures, Steven.
I do have a couple of those. They're tasteful.
Someone is definitely catfishing others as you. So you should.
I would be flattered if I was attractive enough to be a catfishing profile picture. Let's be honest.
I mean, because it's the name of this episode, you're not wrong.
Right. Thank you. Full circle. I mean, to cap that, those people are hot. Like that's
true.
Good. That's a compliment.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. All right, well, let's say goodbye. All right. We'll see y'all next time.